I called my sermon this morning, Fighting for Freedom. That's because that is the theme of the beautiful festival of Hanukkah. And secondly, because it is important in these days to emphasize the thought that freedom is something that must be fought for if it is to be won or held. Freedom is not a gift freely bestowed by anyone upon anyone. It is a prize arduously acquired, which must be safeguarded with the utmost vigilance and frequently with the greatest of sacrifices. It is easy to lose freedom. It is hard to regain it. The Maccabees of old, as you read in that beautiful chapter from the book of the Maccabees, which, by the way, is one of the most exalted books of the Apocrypha, the Maccabees of old fought for their freedom. If they had been unwilling to fight for it, then Judaism in the second century would have disappeared, sunk and lost in the vast sea of paganism of the ancient world, and all that mankind derived subsequently by way of faith and morals, not alone from Judaism, but from its daughter religion, Christianity, would never have materialized. You hear men today, especially those who are opposed to one policy or another, extolling peace with the suggestion of peace at any price. If peace were to be extolled at any price, then we would not praise in our day the American revolutionists who waged a long and desperate war against Great Britain more than 150 years ago, and by whose revolution and whose valor and whose fighting our country was established. We praise these American revolutionists that they preferred to fight for the independence of their country and for the rights as they saw them, in place of accepting the peace of submission. Why do we praise the Hungarian fighters for freedom today? The men and the women who preferred exile or death rather than to submit to the tyranny of a government which had robbed them of all the basic freedoms of life. These men and women could have had freedom, could have had peace without freedom, if they had chosen not to resist, if they had led themselves to believe that peace is to be preferred to all other human values. But peace, my friends, is the supreme good, provided all the other essential goods of human life had first been achieved. It is the crowning good. It is the resultant good. After the values of justice, human rights, human freedoms had been established. Without the establishment of these preliminary requisites for a permanent peace, any peace is but an armistice, a prelude to war. In the days of the Maccabees, as we read in our story, there were many Jews who accepted the peace offer of Antiochus, the Syrian Greek, who was consolidating a powerful empire in Asia Minor. So we read, he gave orders that the people of Judea should forsake the law, that is the Torah, their way of life, and the covenant, which made Israel the guardian and teacher of that faith to the world, profane the Sabbath, which was the symbol of that covenant, and a symbol also of Israel's distinctive life, and pollute the sanctuary, that is to set up the idol of Zeus in the temple in Jerusalem, to indicate to the world that Israel had abandoned its faith in the one spiritual God and that it had reverted to polytheism and idolatry. And upon accepting these orders of King Antiochus, complying with them obediently, these Jews were promised peace. They would not be molested. The purpose of Antiochus, like the purpose of the men in the Kremlin today, like the purpose of the fascists and Nazis before them, was, as the text says, that there should be only one people, only one party, under one leader, one Führer, one Commissar, that there should be Gleichschaltung, that everyone should think alike, speak alike, and act alike, that the state be monolithic. Everyone should forsake his own cherished ideals, his own traditions, his own convictions, and his freedom of choice and his freedom of expression. They should accept the totalitarianism of Antiochus, which is a recurrent totalitarianism throughout the ages, all over the world. It goes by different names. It is championed by different dictators. It's the same thing. And we read that all the heathens agreed according to the commandment of the king. They submitted. They wanted peace. They wouldn't fight for their way of life. It wasn't important enough to them. Peace and security and going about their business and making money was more important to them. And we also read that many Jews consented and set up altars and groves and chapels of idols and sacrificed swine's flesh and profaned the Sabbath and festival days and left their children uncircumcised and their souls abominated with all manners of uncleanness and profanation. These Jews too preferred to be let alone in peace, They prefer peace to defiance, to suffering, to possible death. Howbeit, we read in the book, many in Israel were fully resolved and confirmed in themselves not to conform. They chose rather to die, that they might not have their souls defiled, their spirits betrayed, and themselves enslaved. And I should like to reread those words that Mattathias, the father of those five brave Maccabee sons, said to the officer of King Antiochus, who pleaded with him to become a friend of the king just by accepting his orders. But Mattathias answered and spake with a loud voice, though all the nations that are under king's dominion obey him and fall away each one from the religion of his fathers, yet will I and my sons and my brethren walk, continue to walk in the covenant of our fathers. God forbid that we should forsake the law to depart from our faith either to the right hand or to the left. That is the voice of freedom speaking. That voice spoke in ancient Modin. That voice spoke 1,000 years before through the mouth of Moses. Amidst the slave pens of Egypt, by the banks of the Nile, let my people go. They were not born to be slaves. That same voice broke the silence of the centuries on these shores of ours in 1776, when the founders of the American Republic provoked and infuriated by many acts of injustice and tyranny, finally proclaimed in the name of the laws of nature and of nature's God, man's unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's the same voice that echoed over the blood-stained battlefield of Gettysburg, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And it's the same voice, choked, muffled, and stifled, but the same voice that one hears today from the ravaged cities of Hungary and from its thousands and ten thousands of heroic fighters and refugees who practically bare their breasts to the Russian tanks and who fought almost with bare fists against the brutal might of their own treasonable puppet government. It's always at first, my dear friends, the cry of the few against the many, the weak against the strong. But of the few who do not dismay, again, I refer you to this chapter which I read to you this morning. Judah was about to lead the people into battle against the mighty host of the Syrians, and the people said, what shall we be able, being a small company, to fight against so great and so strong a multitude? The odds were clearly against them. And Judah answered them, with the God of heaven, with the God of freedom, it is all one to save by many or by few. in the Sinai campaign a few weeks ago. The few against the many again confirmed the miracle of Hanukkah. They were always told, you are few, less than 2 million Jews against 40, 50 million Arabs. What chance have you? When they asked the free nations of the world, the free governments of the world, to provide them with arms to defend themselves, they were told, there's no use, you're outnumbered. In 4 days, this freedom inspired forces of Israel, shattered the mighty hosts of Egypt. Egypt, which had accumulated incalculable stores of armament, given to it by the same power which has now broken the freedom fighters in Hungary. Just as 8 years before, they broke the might of 6 invading armies. Masarta giborim beyat halashim, thou hast turned over the mighty into the hands of the weak. The rabim beyat meatim, and the many in the hands of the few. At this moment, the cause of the Hungarian freedom fighters seems hopeless. They have been crushed by the ruthless might of the Red Army. The United Nations is powerless to send even observers into Hungary to report on the situation there. The United Nations and the United States were able to exert great initiative and great determination when the interests of a dictator, of a Nasser, were endangered. Oh, they rushed to his assistance. Quickly. Like a Sir Galahad riding an Arab steed. They rushed in and restored the fallen and defeated and discredited Hitler of the Nile. Restored him back to his throne or his pedestal. But they seem to be quite helpless now, when a suffering people struggling for freedom against brutal invaders of their country, when Hungary pleads for help. The freedom fighters of Hungary are receiving, of course, the admiration and the acclaim of the free world. And perhaps their refugees will be better looked after than the Jewish refugees who a few short years ago, fleeing from terror and the extermination of the Nazis, sought refuge and haven in the free world and were turned away. Shiploads of them had to sail for days and weeks and months, could find nowhere a haven of refuge. They were turned away from our own shores. How quickly we forget it. These victims of Central and Eastern Europe, including Hungary, after both the First and the Second World War, I hope these refugees, Hungarian refugees today, will receive better treatment, will be looked after, will be welcomed. They're entitled to it. It's the least that the free world can do for their country, for them. The lot of freedom fighters is often a very sad and lonely and pitiable one. And the crown of their sorrow is often the fact that they are quickly forgotten by their friends. But this is certain, and the festival of Hanukkah attests to it, that their cause will never perish. It will triumph in the end. Others will take their place, inspired by their example. And wherever a man fights for freedom, in whatever corner of the world, he is fighting for the freedom of all mankind. Soviet dictatorship, in my judgment, received a body thrust in the popular insurrections among its satellites in the last few months, from which it will not recover. There is panic today in the heart of the Kremlin, and its very violence in suppressing these insurrections attests to this fact. Because what has happened? The very first relaxation following the death of Stalin, the very first opportunity which these satellites, oppressed peoples, had of expressing themselves, of voicing what they thought about the Soviet regime, showed, first in the Poznan riots of last summer, and more dramatically in the recent struggle in Budapest and throughout Hungary, how bitterly resentful these peoples are of Soviet domination and exploitation. How unhappy they are under their present political and economic plight. How eager they are, especially the young people among them, for freedom, for national freedom, for personal freedom. That the years of suppression, of indoctrination, propaganda, have not succeeded in quenching the love of freedom in the hearts of these people. And at the first opportunity to express themselves, they demanded first the abrogation of the Warsaw Pact. They wanted to emancipate themselves from the shackle of a pact which denied them the right to decide their own national destinies. Then they demanded the withdrawal of the Red Army. Then they demanded the end of the one-party system. Then they began to clamor for the restoration of the days before communism clamped down upon them. And there is doom written large for this communistic military imperialism in this upsurgence, this remarkable upsurgence of these people. And the men in the Kremlin realize this full well. And they have responded in two ways. First, in very drastic concessions which they were forced to make to Gomulka in Poland. And these concessions, in my judgment, are only the first phase of other concessions which will have to be wrested and will be wrested from the Kremlin. And secondly, in the mad and brutal acts of suppression in Hungary. It may well be that as a result of what has happened in the satellite countries, that an effort will be made to restore brutal Stalinism in the Soviet Empire. To go back to the days of Stalin in order to get itself out of the predicament in which it finds itself at times. But it will not succeed. The Soviet Union will have to democratize or disintegrate. And dictatorships do not democratize except through revolution. And so I believe that the day of the great inner revolution within the Soviet Union itself is not far off. Liberty and freedom cannot be permanently denied to men. There is a Jewish interest in what has transpired in Hungary today. Among the refugees who are now fleeing from Hungary are also Jews. There are not many Jews left in Hungary. About 110,000 all told. All that has remained of a great and glorious community of more than 1 million souls. The Jews loved Hungary, fought for its freedom. In the revolution of 1848, the Jews contributed 11% of the volunteers who fought for the freedom of Hungary, more than three times the proportion of the rest of the population. Their numbers became seriously depleted after the First and Second World Wars and after the first communist occupation of Hungary under Béla Kun and the second one of the last 9 years. Hungary was on the losing side of both world wars. And the resultant unhappiness of the people and the dislocation of the life of the country contributed, as it always does, to the growth of anti-Semitism. An anti-Semitic movement spread in Hungary, and anti-Jewish legislation was enacted. Following the short-lived communist regime which Béla Kun set up after the First World War, Béla Kun, who was a Jew, though not a professing Jew, like other Bolsheviks. Following the collapse of his short-lived regime, the Jews of Hungary were held responsible for all the evils the Dutch regime perpetrated in Hungary. And severe punitive measures were taken against them. White terror was instituted. Numerous Clausius laws were enacted. Somewhat later, these laws were relaxed, but in the meantime, many Jews left Hungary. With the rise of Nazism in Germany in the early 30s, and especially after the Nazis took over Austria, Hungary's neighbor, anti-Semitic movements within Hungary were fostered and encouraged by the Nazi regime in Berlin. Anti-Semitic agitation spread through Hungary. And anti-Jewish laws were enacted in 1938 and 1939, which restricted the civil rights of the Jews in Germany. Their representation in business and in the professions. And following Hungary's defeat in the Second World War, with the coming of the communists again into power, the Jews became the victims of the communist regime. Jewish businessmen were expropriated. Jewish liberals were either killed or driven out of the country, liquidated. Mass deportation of Jews took place in 1951 and 1952, and they were sent east to labor camps in Siberia. And most of the remaining Jews in Hungary in the last few years have registered for emigration to Israel, but opportunity for such emigration has not been granted them. This is not a very happy lot for the Jews of Hungary in the last generation, for a community which in the second half of the 19th century and in the early 20th century was one of the most important and creative Jewish communities in the world. The Jews of Hungary played a vast and decisive role in the commercial and cultural life of Hungary. They founded its key industries. They developed its export trade. They built its railroads. The list of Hungary's great in the fields of the arts and the sciences is largely a list of Hungarian Jews. Their Magyarized names are frequently misleading. In every field, in literature, art, medicine, mathematics, music, Oriental studies, in every conceivable field of the arts and the sciences, the Jews of Hungary made monumental contributions, not alone to the life of their country, but to the life of mankind. It's pathetic to see what has remained of that marvelous community. Well, for us to recall that the two great leaders of Zionism, Dr. Theodor Herzl and Dr. Max Nordau, were Hungarian Jews. Their lot has been an unhappy one. For that matter, the lot of the Hungarian people in the last generation has been an unhappy one. As has been the lot of other nations since our world collapsed into this bloody mess of two world wars and communist revolutions. What is the hope for the future? The hope of the future, my dear friend, lies in those who remain faithful to the light of freedom, however dimmed it may be at the moment. Those who, like the Maccabees of old, stand by their faith, their convictions, and are prepared to make sacrifices for them. That is why the heroic fighters of Hungary are to be looked upon more than mere Hungarian patriots. They are fighters for the freedom of mankind, regardless what their nationality is or their religion is. From the festival of Hanukkah and its message, we may take courage for the future. The free spirit of man is indefeasible. Man will not be permanently chained. And the free world today, once it can get together again, and consolidate its spirit and its resources, and begin to think more of freedom and justice and of oil, and shabby political maneuvering, and think in the terms of the large issues, the eternal issues of mankind. Once the free world reunites, consolidates its strength and its resources, and begins again its crusade for human freedom, freedom will make monumental strides in the days to come. The little cruse of oil, it couldn't burn more than one night in the temple. Burnt night after night for 8 long nights. That's the miracle of the free spirit of man. Let us bear it in mind and be grateful for that recurrent miracle in all ages. Amen.